Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the Hazara people originated in Afghanistan and some migrated to other countries in the region. They have faced much persecution in Afghanistan as well as in Pakistan. And it doesn't seem to matter which government comes to power in Kabul or Islamabad. The bloodshed and oppression of the Hazara continues. Why? Well, stay with us on this debate as we take a look at these questions and others, analyzing the state of affairs of the Hazara minority community.
At least seven members of Afghanistan's persecuted Hazara ethnic group have been brutally murdered. The killing occurred near the eastern city of Jalalabad, close to the Pakistani border, last week.
There is a plaster factory in this area. Hundreds of our Hazara brothers are coming here and work as laborers. Last night, some unknown gunmen attacked the factory and murdered seven innocent laborers. First, they had their hands bound behind their backs, and then they were killed in different parts of the factory. I think each one was shot by one bullet.
The victims were migrant laborers from the Hazara community, which makes up some 20% of the Afghan population. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack on the Shia minority that has long been persecuted by extremist groups.
We are sad about the attack. We don't know why it's happening. The government doesn't care for us. If we keep weapons for our safety, the government confiscates our weapons, and we don't know what to do. The incident happened, and these poor people were martyred, and the enemy is not known.
The Hazaras have increasingly taken the brunt of rising violence across Afghanistan, with militant suicide bombers attacking their mosques, schools, rallies, and hospitals. The Hazaras have long been persecuted for their faith. They are even being targeted outside Afghanistan. In January, 11 Hazara coal miners were slain by Daesh terrorists in the Pakistani city of Quetta. Miners were kidnapped by gunmen from a remote colliery before being taken to nearby hills, where most of them were shot dead. Some others were beheaded. The killing prompted massive protests across Pakistan. Mourners refused to bury the dead for days, calling for justice, something they have been demanding for decades. Although the governments of both Afghanistan and Pakistan have time and again promised to protect the Shia minority group, the Hazaras are still easy targets for extremist groups. They've had a few allies in Afghanistan over the generations. They say even if peace finally comes to Afghanistan, their chance of living in peace is very slim unless the Afghan government protects the Hazaras the same way it protects other Afghan communities.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program out of London, from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Reza Qasim, and out of Toronto, journalist and analyst Faya Sahak. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off with Reza in London. In your perspective, what is behind the oppression against the Hazara?
I think this is something that we need to recognize, that in terms of what the government is, or governments have been doing, is very little to actually protect this. There is the idea of creating a sectarian tension within the discourse, within the narrative, within the reality of Pakistan, to make it look target people because of their ethnicity, because of their religious affiliations and so on. So to create and stoke tensions within, for the sake of the politics of Pakistan, which are internationally engineered sometimes from Saudi Arabia. So there is that dimension that's actually going on, as well as the local kind of takfiri, kind of sectarian attitudes that are there, and some of the takfiri killers that are actually allowed to be let loose within Pakistan, and also very little is actually done with regards to what's going on in Afghanistan on this matter.
And Faiz, your take, I mean, we have seen more attacks against the community in Afghanistan. Your perspective about that side of things, why do you think that is the case?
Well, despite the scarcity of data on extent and nature and drivers of such attacks, it seems that the Shia communities, particularly the Hazaras, are under threat. But I don't agree that Hazaras in Afghanistan are facing more threats than others. It could be right in Pakistan. I traveled to Pakistan, and I also traveled to the tribal areas of Pakistan, and also to Quetta. It's one of the places where you can find more Hazaras. Things are not good there. Hazaras have been repeatedly attacked by the Taliban and other terrorist groups that have sanctuaries, and they are being equipped and trained in those areas, and they have been able to attack such communities in that part of the region. But in Afghanistan, I see that Hazaras have not faced more attacks than others. What's happening in Afghanistan is that all the people of this of Afghanistan have been attacked, and they have suffered a lot, mostly because of the Taliban brutal attacks that they continue to do in major cities of this country. That is the political context of that country. But if you look at the social and socioeconomic situation of Afghanistan, you would see that the Hazaras live now, like many others, in rural communities, and they're faced with conflict and also natural disasters that have prompted a large number of Hazaras and also other local communities coming from different ethnic and ethnic backgrounds to migrate and get displaced from one location to another. When they get displaced inside the country, they don't have access to basic services, livelihood, and shelter. These drivers prompt them to migrate to the regional countries, including Iran and Pakistan. And then if you look at the migration situation in these two countries, they stay there for a short period of time if they're not accompanied by their families, and they earn some money and they come back, they go back to their country. In others, if they have more of a cash, they go to Turkey and then run to Europe. These are the migration trends and the challenges that the Afghan people are faced with. But I believe that the Afghan government, as well as the regional countries, because Pakistan and Iran are also faced with these migration, irregular migration trends, we can say, and the international community, particularly the United Nations agencies, need to look at these drivers of terrorist attacks very thoroughly and come up with evidence-based programming and policymaking.
Okay, we will be looking at the international aspect behind us, but Reza, let's look at the attacks themselves. How likely do you think that foreign powers are actually behind a lot of these attacks and oppression?
I think we cannot ignore that particular dimension. I think it needs to be considered as a driver for what's actually going on within this kind of context. I mean, we know that the tool that is being used and weaponized is the tool of sectarianism, of sectarian divisions, and to create and foment strife and sectarian division within the context of Pakistan, within the context of Afghanistan. I think if we ignore this particular driver, we are overlooking a major factor in what's actually going on within this context of Pakistan and Afghanistan and what's happening to the Hazara community. There's also something that we need to keep very much in mind when we're looking at the policy making steps that the other guest mentioned, that there is a need for both of those governments to protect the citizens of their country. We have seen in the case of Pakistan, for example, that when Imran Khan was not prime minister, and a similar thing happened in Quetta a few years back, going back a few years, he had promised that how dare this kind of thing happen, and security needs to be provided for these people. And yet we see him in the position of prime minister, and very little is actually being done. In fact, if anything, some of those people who are seen to be behind the killings have actually been played around with within the context of the army, allowing them free rein to do what they wish to do, and not much being done to rein those people in. And some of those strings are being pulled from Saudi Arabia with the nodding and the wink and nudges and so on from the Western governments to allow this sectarian tension, not just allow to actually grow the sectarianism and to foment the sectarianism, so that anything that happens within the context of local politics, so something that was touted quite frequently was the fact that the normalization that was going on of Israel within the Middle Eastern countries was something that was very much behind this, to actually force Pakistan to actually go down this route and force Imran Khan to go down this route, that look, we can unleash these forces in your country if you do not actually do something about this particular thing. So we need to keep this in that context, that international dimension of sectarianism. And, you know, sectarianism can go back to how Saudi Arabia was using this back in the 80s in terms of what was going on there.
Okay, well, Fayez, I'm looking at the international side of things, and basically we don't really hear that much about the Hazaras. It's not usually covered in the media. I mean, your perspective about that, why don't we really hear about this oppression that's been going on for so long?
Well, you don't hear about it because you don't hear it from Afghanistan, because, as I mentioned earlier, it's not only the Hazaras that are being attacked by terrorist groups, I would say. You have just recently heard from the United Nations that civilian casualties continue to rise in this country. And now we are talking about Hazaras at a very important time, I believe, that the Taliban and Americans are talking about their deal that was signed during when Trump was in the White House. I believe that there would, if we don't fix this deal, there would be more unrest. Let's not forget that they are now talking about an interior government.
So let me just jump in here, Fayez. Let me just jump in here, Fayez, with what you said. So you said if the deal is not fixed, you will hear more of this. So do you think that if the United States and the its allies would leave Afghanistan, we would see a safer Afghanistan, we would see less violence? Is that what you're saying?
Well, if you look at the situation in Afghanistan at the moment, the bulk of military operations are carried out by the Afghan security forces. It's the Afghan military forces that are on the front lines fighting against the Taliban militants. The Trump administration has been able to get American forces inside their military bases. Now, Taliban, based on the terms and conditions of this new deal that they signed with the U.S. government, don't attack American forces, even if they come face-to-face in Afghanistan. So that is the deal. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that they turned their back on Afghans. Now, back to your questions, what would happen if Americans leave Afghanistan? We now have 2,500 American forces in Afghanistan. We are not worried about the withdrawal of American forces from the region, including Afghanistan, because Afghanistan is not the only country in the region where American forces are based. I would say that if the Taliban are allowed to come and hold more territories, and they are not encouraged, or we can say forced, to accept the current political structure and respect the basic rights of minorities in Afghanistan, I believe things would get worse, and people should be worried about that. And when it comes to sectarian violence, as Reza pointed out, it's if you look at this, yes, Hazaras were under threat, and it dates back to many years, but it's not only one factor. Many social and political factors, the combination of many factors, has led to the rise of such attacks in the region, in Afghanistan, and I can say also in Pakistan.
Well, Reza, let's talk about the other side of things, the international community, and putting pressure on these countries to protect this community. Are we seeing that, or what needs to be done in order to make that a reality, or should that be a reality in your perspective?
I think one of the things that we need to recognize within the narrative and the discourse that we actually have about American meddling in Afghanistan or in other countries, or Western meddling in Afghanistan or in other countries, that the situation has not been helped. Things haven't got better. Things have actually got worse. So I think the first thing that would be useful is for American and Western meddling within Afghanistan and other countries of that region to actually stop. And I think the way that forward is for actually regional countries to actually try and work out the best way to actually move forward within this
context. So, Reza, sorry to interrupt you. I just want to see what you're saying also. So are you saying that actually if American forces and American influence is less in this region, for example, we're talking about Afghanistan or Pakistan and other countries, you feel that regional countries are strong enough to protect themselves and its minorities? Or explain exactly what you're saying.
So, for example, in terms of the people who are going to be getting the armaments and so on, where are they getting the armaments from? We have long history documented. Secretaries of State of the United States and so on
they're
and so forth.
They're getting it from Pakistan,
how they
arm people. They're getting the arms from Pakistan.
Very much something that was part and parcel of what was actually going on within this context. So we need to try and make sure that this
Let me just jump in here, Reza, because I'm not sure you could hear Fayez. I want your comment on what he's saying, because Fayez is saying that they're getting it from Pakistan. They're getting their arms from Pakistan.
Pakistan is one vehicle, absolutely. I don't disagree with that at all. But ultimately, Pakistan isn't rich enough, nor has got the, the Pakistani army is a key player, and the direction that it goes in, it is also, it has its own local interests, but its interests are also allied with the interests of America and Western meddling. I mean, we see that. I mean, historically, we can see that these kind of things were going on. We also have India supplying arms to, what is termed as the Indian Taliban. Those kind of regional things are, forces that are at play are definitely there. But the issue is that this has been exacerbated, and these problems have been created and magnified by American presence, by Western meddling, whether it's British Western meddling, French, or whatever you want to call it, in different areas, in order to carry on the colonial project. It's a new colonial project. And we need to keep that history in context, that who is actually benefiting from all of this, because it's not the regional, the people of the region that are benefiting. People are being propped up and kept in power within that region, in certain states, to actually control the population in order that the American and the Western policies and so on will be implemented for the benefit of Western politicians and Western powers and so on and so forth. So we need to keep that context in mind. And this is a long history, centuries-old history of meddling that has actually been going on. And it's something that needs to be recognized that it's still continuing today. It has become more nuanced when it comes from the British. But how it comes from the Americans, it's more gung-ho and more in your face, but that kind of stuff is still going on there. And we need to say that needs to be rejected. Unless that fundamental policy is adopted by the countries of the region, I'm afraid to say that these problems are actually going to continue. I mean, we've seen that happen.
Let me give the final 30 seconds to Fayez. Fayez, your final comments. Do you think that peace can come to this minority group, and what do you think it will take?
Well, I think that the regional countries and as well as international community in general need to support the current Afghan government in order to provide more protection to the Afghan people in all geographical locations of that country. It's not only the Hazaras, it's also other groups that are suffering the most. There is widespread unemployment and grim poverty in the region. I think that the regional countries at this critical juncture need to support the Afghan government so they have more support and be able to strengthen its economy. As Reza has pointed out, if regional countries support Afghanistan, I don't think Pakistan would need that kind of support, because Pakistan is one of the allies of the United States. They won't need that. If they don't have any connection with America, they would go and bow down to China. I think Afghanistan needs to be supported by the regional countries so that it doesn't turn into another hell for the regional countries. I can say with confidence that if the Taliban return and they grab power without respecting the rights of minorities, women and children, I think that would be a big threat not only to Iran and Pakistan, but to the entire world.
On that note, I'd like to thank my guests for being with us on this debate, from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Reza Kazim out of London, and journalist and analyst Fayez Sahak out of Toronto. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi signing out for myself and other crew right here in Tehran.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Qad aflahal mu'minun.
Certainly will the believers have succeeded.
الذين هم في صلاتهم خاشعون.
They who are during their prayer humbly submissive.
والذين هم عن اللغو معرضون.
And they who turn away from ill speech.
Brothers and sisters, we were giving you some kind of general view on the contents of this surah before we get into details and talk about the different verses of this chapter. We mentioned that the contents of this surah are mostly about the special attributes of the believers. In the first part, continuing for several verses, this surah mentions some of the attributes that lead to the salvation of the believers. In the second part, the verses mention the different signs of knowing Allah that can be found in the world of existence, both in microcosm and macrocosm. In the third part, to complete the practical dimensions of the noble surah, the verses cite the instructive biography of some of the great prophets, such as Noah, Hud, Prophet Musa, and Jesus, peace be upon him, as a few examples by mentioning certain aspects of their lives. And then, in the fourth part, the chapter addresses the arrogant, sometimes by appealing to their logical reason, sometimes by warning them in harsh tones, in order to arouse the consciousness of the receptive ones and find their way back to Allah. And then, next to that, the verses contain some concise discussions on the subject of resurrection. And in the sixth part, the verses talk about both Allah's sovereignty over the world of existence and irresistibility of His command over the entire universe. And then, when we reach the ending verses of this surah, the resurrection, the weighing of deeds, the reward for those who do right and the punishment for those who do wrong are again mentioned. And the noble surah ends by mentioning the aim of the creation of man, which is a necessary point in knowing the program of life and how to achieve salvation and deliverance. So, the content of this surah is a collection of some cognitive issues that encourages us to reflect and the doctrinal and practical lessons. And from the beginning of the surah to the end, talk about the entire path that the believers must pave. We mentioned that this surah was revealed in Mecca, yet some commentators of the Holy Quran have said that some of its verses had been revealed in Medina. And this is because it contains a verse that refers to the almsgiving or zakat.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
Since paying zakat was first legislated in Medina, this fact has led them to think that the complete surah could not have been revealed in Mecca, because it is known that zakat was at first legislated in Medina after the revelation of the verse خُدْ مِنْ أَمْوَالِهِمْ صَدَقَةً, which is mentioned in the 103rd verse of chapter Tawbah, take out of their possessions alms. So by this verse, the Prophet ﷺ ordered the tax collectors and alms collectors to go around and collect this tax from the people. And with respect to this issue, we must be aware, however, that the zakat also has a general meaning. It includes both obligatory and recommended zakat. So its meaning is not limited to the obligatory sadaqah or zakat alone, because we can see in the Islamic narrations that the ritual prayer and the payment of this tax has often been mentioned together. A narration from Imam Sadiq and Imam Baqir alayhim as-salam says, Allah has made the alms tax along with the ritual prayer obligatory. So some Islamic scholars believe that the alms tax had also been obligatory in Mecca, but it was general and somehow undefined. It means that everyone was obliged to give some part of his possessions to the needy. But when the Islamic government was established in Medina, a precise system was devised for regulating and collecting, and after that distributing this zakat, along with specifying the minimum value of property upon which it should be collected by the Prophet's agents. So we still believe that the contents and the verses of this surah were all revealed in Mecca. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me. Why ends when faith begins?
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, we send our peace and blessings upon the Prophet and his progeny, and those companions who followed their path. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and welcome to another program for a better life here on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about different psychological diseases and social issues that we have in the society and within us. And what we have said in the past programs concerning giving attention to the present does not mean that one should do something today without paying attention to its evil consequences in the future. So you concentrate on the now, you concentrate on the present, you try to be happy right now doing whatever you are doing and concentrating with only doing that act or deed and not allowing your thoughts to fly away. But at the same time, you have in mind what awaits you for the future. What we mean is that one should not let one's peace of mind be disturbed by regret for the past and fear regarding the future. We have different needs, and these needs and the deprivations cause suffering. And for this reason, the majority of people might live in a battlefield against needs and desires and deprivation. Those of us who have our material needs satisfied, we usually face other obstacles, and one of them is spiritual agony. We do not have spiritual well-being. In order to escape this state of nervousness and agitation, we often opt for methods and ways that lead to destruction of our vital and intellectual powers. What do I mean with that? For instance, we take, some of us, refuge in alcohol or drugs like cigarettes, tobacco, alcoholic beverages, and other kinds of drugs, which appear to us as the only remedy, and we become addicted to it. We become addicted to these destructive evils so as to escape our anguish, our inner torment for a short time. We think that we can do nothing else except seeking refuge in alcoholism or drug addiction or workaholism and the other isms that we can refer to when it comes to escaping this inner torment that we have, this agony that we feel within ourselves.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
We turn towards these isms to relieve ourselves from the pain and suffering. But in reality, dear brothers and sisters, these things undermine our own personality. For everyone knows that addiction to these things for relief from anxiety and stress and inner distress does not lead to good consequences. Every one of us knows this fact. For as soon as the effect of intoxication of these poisonous drugs are gone, our anguish returns to badly torment us again. Moreover, the effect produced by these drugs is gradually diminished due to continuous use, and they themselves give rise to many other diseases and afflictions, physical, mental, and spiritual. Psychologists explain the causes of taking refuge in these isms, which one of them is alcoholism, the other one is workaholism, and so on and so forth, as follows. Those who are used to alcohol are not capable of satisfying their wants in a complex and complicated world. Therefore, in order to evade difficulties, to escape difficulties, and delve in unrealistic fancies, we take resort in alcohol or other drugs. Alcohol or other drugs make a drastic effect on the nervous system. And in addition to that, dear brothers and sisters, enfeebles the rational faculty that we have, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us. We can't use it properly. One who is drunk or intoxicated or drugged behaves in an unnatural manner. And intoxication does an irremediable harm to us. We not only injure our own wealth and health, but we also injure those we love the most.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
We achieve nothing by escaping problems by taking resort in an harmful beverage or other drugs. Ultimately, we even lose respect in the eyes of our friends, families, and relatives. When we return to our ordinary state, our capacity to confront our difficulties is further diminished. The consumption of alcohol and other drugs does not afford any progress in the solution of problems. And one who makes alcohol and other drugs a means of escaping problems only makes his hardships graver. And these difficulties, again, forces us to turn towards alcohol and drugs. So it is an evil cycle, dear brothers and sisters, which I will talk more about, inshallah, in the future programs. Thank you for joining us in this program for a better life here on IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is on a need. All I need, all I need, all I need, all I need, oh, 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 all I need, all I need, and I know that you see how much you need. You mean to me, 'cause your love is all I need, to be all I can be. And I know that you see how much you mean to me.
Your love is all I need.
Round the world with reporters.
The Nigerian government has described the commencement of this vaccination exercise of Nigerians as a historic moment in the fight against the COVID-19. The kickoff of the vaccination followed the delivery of close to 4 million doses of the COVAX AstraZeneca vaccines to Nigeria on 2nd March 2021. Nigerian health officials said the delay in the start of the vaccination was to ensure that the vaccines were checked for safety.
The vaccines that we're going to be delivering today to Nigerians are safe, they're effective, and we're going to roll out this vaccine in a very efficient manner, just like we all work together as one country and defeated the white polio viruses. Today, it feels proud to be a Nigerian. All of you should be proud.
The Nigerian government said Nigerians should support the planned and systematic rollout of the vaccines and mobilize citizens for the vaccination exercise. The United Nations Children Fund, UNICEF, played an important role in the arrival of the vaccines and says the successful battle against the COVID-19 will impact positively on routine immunization of Nigerian children against the other preventable childhood killer diseases.
UNICEF was the organization that did the procurement and the delivery of those vaccines on the 2nd of March. And we're very, very pleased that today we're able to administer them. But also now the challenge is getting them to the states, and the states starting to vaccinate the health, the frontline workers, the health workers, so that they can be protected as quickly as is possible.
This medical doctor becomes the first Nigerian at this occasion to be given the COVID-19 vaccination. He has been a frontline health worker since March 2020 and has lost his father to the COVID-19. 158,000 Nigerians have so far been infected with the COVID-19, and over 1,900 have died of the disease. The World Health Organization has stated that the vaccines have undergone rigorous regulatory processes at global and country level and have been certified safe and effective. The next challenge for Nigerian health officials is how to reach millions of Nigerians in remote rural communities. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Anti-monarchy activists showed up at the headquarters of Spain's car manufacturer SEAT in the north of Barcelona to protest a visit by King Felipe and Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez. Protesters shouted slogans against the monarch and held banners reading "Catalonia has no king," 1 week after violent riots shook the region over the imprisonment of a rapper for insulting Spanish royals.
The rejection of the Spanish monarchy has become a recurring theme with every royal visit to Catalonia over the past years. Here are some of the grievances with regard to this particular visit to the car factory.
The King of Spain will never be welcome in Catalonia. The King of the October 3rd speech, the King who 3.5 years ago called business owners to urge them to relocate their headquarters out of Catalonia, is not welcome.
The Spanish government Thursday announced it will dedicate part of the Coronavirus European Recovery Fund to launch an electric car battery plant with SEAT's parent company, Volkswagen. But trade unions say the transition towards a greener economy requires transparent labor reforms and should not overlook basic rights.
We need to know how the European Recovery Fund is going to be spent. We believe it should be entirely put under public administration. The investments in the car industry should be in compliance with public interest first, and that includes taking into account the reduction of the average working hours in view of the increasing automation.
The automotive industry in Spain generates nearly 2 million direct and indirect jobs. It represents 10% of the GDP and 19% of total exports. Declining sales and extended shutdowns due to the coronavirus pandemic have forced Japanese car maker Nissan last year to shut down one of its 3 plants in Catalonia. Kasai Kadrip, Barcelona.
In his very first campaign speech to win the presidential election, Joe Biden promised to more than double the federal minimum wage from just over $7 an hour to a minimum of $15 per hour. However, the ruling Democratic Party has retracted the wage increase from the third fiscal stimulus negotiations, disappointing 30 million low-wage workers in the middle of a once-in-a-century economic crisis. There is a whopping 75% public approval rating for Biden's stimulus program, but those polls came out before many of the details were released. Biden has since pulled support for many of the economic promises he made during his election campaign. After just 1 month in office, Biden has so far backtracked on his promises for major student debt relief, the amount of and length of unemployment payments, the total amount of household stimulus checks, and he has made no mention of reversing Donald Trump's signature tax cuts for the rich, something that Biden promised to initiate on his very first day in office.
It really shows the bankruptcy of every 4 years, this incrementalism where the left in the United States is pressured into getting behind the Democratic candidate, not going third party. Why? Because, oh, well, we're going to get these small concessions, like something like, hey, a $15 minimum wage increase or student loan debt, things like that.
However, countless economists insist that a wage increase would stimulate the economy overall by giving workers more money to spend, thus creating jobs and badly needed growth.
By doing that, by saying that, you know, it's impacting small businesses, what they're effectively doing is taking the economic burden that's put on small businesses by corporations, which own and control the politicians in Washington, they're shifting that burden onto workers and making workers pay the price.
The so-called fight for $15 began shortly after 2009, which is the last year the federal minimum wage was increased. But a decade later, studies show that constant inflation means that $15 per hour in 2021 would not constitute a living wage for a single adult household in any state. The study said in the cheapest metropolitan areas, $20 per hour is now required, while major cities would need $25 per hour. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
India claims violence has dropped significantly in Kashmir since New Delhi stripped the region of its special status in 2019. However, local politicians accused the Indian government of silencing Kashmiri people by installing an atmosphere of fear. The question is, who is telling the truth? A lot has changed since India ended Kashmir's special status in August 2019. The region is now open to investors and non-locals who want to live there. Kashmir is also now open to workers from other parts of India. None of this was possible before New Delhi ended Kashmir's autonomy. India has been changing the laws applying to Kashmir on a wide scale since then, and these moves have gone largely unopposed. How has there not been any major agitation inside Kashmir? Political analysts believe the apparent silence does not mean the people of the region have consented to India's actions.
It is not silence, rather enforced silence because of a situation of a sort of martial law or emergency. Undeclared martial law, undeclared emergency that was imposed upon them in 2019. And since most of their leadership was put behind the jails, activists of all sorts were also detained. Therefore, a sort of muteness remained there.
Although the people of Kashmir are unhappy with New Delhi's recent decisions and policy changes, they fear that dissenting would have adverse repercussions.
When India decided to scrap Kashmir's special status, we were promised to be given more opportunities, jobs and accessibility. But soon after August 5, 2019, they did the total opposite of what they had promised. The worst thing is that we cannot even oppose it. And if we do so, we will end up in jail. What India has done is completely authoritarian and undemocratic.
However, despite a growing crackdown in the region, the recent ceasefire between India and Pakistan has brought a ray of hope.
Neither the silence is permanent, nor their postures, hard postures, are permanent. They are compelled because of international situations to dilute. I have often mentioned that Kashmir is a volcano which remains dormant for a while, but it erupts and surprises everyone. So the only solution to it is that the core issue and aspirations of people should be addressed so that people have a sense of achievement.
Kashmir has been a bone of contention between Islamabad and New Delhi ever since India broke from British rule in 1947. Pakistan and India each control a part of the region, but both claim it in full. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
$1.7 billion was pledged in the latest UN donor conference for Yemen, which is less than half of what was targeted. The United Nations described the pledges as disappointing. Yemeni people say they don't want the UN to continue begging for aid, but rather they want the Saudi-led war to be ended and the blockade lifted.
We said that we do not need any humanitarian support. They only have to stop the war and lift the siege on Yemen. And the Yemenis, with their capabilities and resources, can obtain their basic needs. Yet this conference came to glorify the countries participating in the war on Yemen and present them as a country supporting humanitarian work.
Human rights activists say the UN seeks to fulfill its programs through such campaigns, since what reaches the people in need is much less than what it spends as operational expenses for its local organizations.
The donors' conference is an attempt to cover the UN failure in managing humanitarian aid that has caused an increase in the need as well as the money that is gained. It's not aimed at covering the real need in Yemen, but rather to ensure the continuity of the work of the UN organizations, where about 70% of these insufficient funds are spent as operational expenses for organizations' programs.
According to the United Nations, Yemenis are experiencing the world's worst humanitarian crisis since the beginning of 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a devastating war on the impoverished country.
Yemenis say the UN campaigns and initiatives are useless unless they are associated with real steps to stop the ongoing war and the blockade on Yemen that have led to the death of tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children, and is still going on. عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنعاء.
Britain, France and Germany drop a resolution against Iran at the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors. Iran's ambassador to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, said most board members agreed that now is not the time for a resolution criticizing Iran's cooperation with the agency. Tehran had warned the three European states the adoption of such a resolution would be interpreted as an end to the joint understanding between Iran and the IAEA reached more than a week ago, allowing the agency to continue with necessary verification work in the country. Gharibabadi said the E3 exercised a prudent approach by considering the consequences of their proposal.
We welcome such an approach by the Board of Governors and also the E3 countries, and it shows that the wisdom prevails, actually. And in my view, by stopping the process of pursuing this resolution, an unnecessary tension was prevented.
IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi said Tehran had accepted his initiative to engage in a focused, systematic effort to clarify a number of outstanding issues.
We were able to have an understanding, and we are going to be starting this process of focused analysis of the situation with a technical meeting, which will take place in Iran the beginning of April, which I hope will be followed by other technical or political meetings as agreed by both sides.
Grossi said his intention is to come to a satisfactory outcome in time for the next regular session of the board next June. The agency says it wants to clarify questions concerning the presence of uranium particles at undeclared locations in Iran. Iran has already provided the agency with complementary access to three locations. Iran's ambassador to the IAEA says Tehran is also determined to resolve the remaining issues, although it does not believe in setting artificial deadlines. Homalezki, Vienna.
Preliminary data released by the National Bureau of Statistics is that shows that absolute poverty levels in Italy reached a 15-year high in 2020, Last year, the number of families facing absolute poverty climbed to 7.7% from 6.4% in 2019, translating into more than 2 million households not being able to afford the minimum standards of living, which include food, adequate shelter, and health care.
We had more than 1 million additional poor in 2020 compared to the year before. However, it must be said that growing poverty levels have also been recorded.